Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
Welcome. Good evening. Now in the era of online things, I should say, or good afternoon, or good morning, or late at night, depending on where you are, as we all say. I'll be brief. My name is Ken Shadlin. I'm a professor in the Department of International Development. And I have the great honor and pleasure to be chairing this event for Professor Elliot Green, Industrialization and National Identity in Modern Africa. He's the star of the show here, so I won't take up much time. I'll just give a brief background and introduction and say a few words. Elliot is a professor in the department. He's been here. I've known Elliot for, well, I arrived at LSE in 2002, so I've been here for 22 years, and Elliot was already here when I was here. He was a PhD student in the department when I arrived. So I've been working with Elliot, knowing Elliot, talking about ideas with Elliot for, you know, I want to say half my life, but unfortunately it's a smaller fraction than that, but for a long time, and it's been very enriching for me, so it's a real honor to have been invited or been asked to chair this event. Elliot, as I said, he did his PhD here. He also did his master's at LSE, and prior to that, he did his undergraduate degree at Princeton University. Elliot's one of these academics who has exceptionally broad research interests on issues of national identity, ethnicity, industrial development, long-term development trajectories, provision of public goods, identity formation. He's a principally an Africanist, but he works across and talks to people who work across the globe. His book that came out a couple years ago that I have here, Industrialization and Assimilation, Understanding Ethnic Change in the Modern World, has been very well received. But beyond the book, Elliot really does, I think, in the true sort of one of the things we're proud about in the Department of International Development, publish with a wide range of other academics. He has economists as colleagues, he has sociologists as colleagues, political scientists, and so on. He's sort of quintessentially interdisciplinary scholar who publishes in top journals in many fields. Has been a wonderful colleague for the 22 years that I've been here, and I regard him as a friend as well, and again, it's an honor to chair this event. Let me just say two other things about Elliot before turning it over. One is that we actually realize that we grew up right around the corner from each other. I mean, I think I'm 10 or so years older than Elliot, but it turns out that we went to rival high schools. We're duking it out against each other. But the other, outside of Chicago, which we have in common with the president of LSE. But the other thing I want to say about Elliot that's super impressive is that he's actually become self-taught econometrician. Like, Elliot does work that sort of cutting-edge work with in leading journals with economists and political scientists. But that's not what he was trained in. It's not what his undergraduate degree was in. It's not what his master's degree was in. It's not what he did his PhD in. There's no regression tables in your PhD. He decided that basically he wanted to be able to dialogue with scholars who did sort of advanced econometric work, and he went out and learned how to do it, which is really impressive. So I'm going to turn it over to you, Elliot. I look forward to it. He'll speak, then we'll have quick Q&A from here and from the world, the internet. And I really look forward to this event. Over to you, Champ.
Thank you. Thank you, Ken. Thanks for the wonderful introduction. Thank you all for coming, and thanks to those online who are also watching this. So I'm going to just highlight what I'm going to do here, just like a typical lecturer. I'll try to keep this to around 40 minutes, 45 minutes or so. And to leave plenty of time for Q&A. So what I'm going to start out with, you see the title, right? It's about industrialization and national identity in Africa. And I'm going to talk a little bit about why I'm here, why I came to the LSE to study nationalism. And also I'm going to talk about the most famous author, or probably the best author, in my opinion, on the subject of nationalism, which is Ernest Gellner, a longtime professor here at the LSE. And I'll talk about Africa, why we want to use Africa, why we want to study nationalism in Africa, some evidence for that. I'll talk about a couple of case studies, and then I'll conclude. So first of all, LSE and the study of nationalism. This is Ernest Gellner. This is the focus, really a theoretical grounding for this talk and for a lot of my current work. Ken gave my brief bio there. So I did start studying the subject of nationalism as an undergraduate student in the US. I was interested in German nationalism at the time. And I wanted to do a master's degree, as one does. And I wanted to study nationalism. And the best place to do that in the world was here at the LSE. And the reason for that is because of people like Gellner. Gellner was here, you see his dates, the dates of 1949 to 1984 was when he was a professor here, before I think he moved to Cambridge and then eventually the Central European University, which still has a very good nationalism studies program. Another professor at the LSE was famous, was Elie Kaduri, who taught here for decades in the International Relations Department. Anthony Smith was actually the person who taught me for my master's, and I knew him until he died. He was the founder of the Association for the Study of Ethnicity and Nationalism, which I joined as a PhD student, and I'm currently one of the vice presidents of that organization. It's the organization that publishes two journals, Nations and Nationalism being the more prominent journal that they publish. John Burley, more recently John Burley and John Hutchinson, who's still on the faculty of the government department. And among other people who've been at the LSE, there's a long list of people who've taught and studied nationalism at the LSE over many decades, including one of our former, at that point, would have been director, Anthony Giddens. Michael Ignatieff, some of you may know him as an academic or a failed Canadian politician, and also then later on the president of the Central European University. When I came here to study, he was actually giving a series of lectures, pro bono, I think, as a visiting scholar. Brendan O'Leary used to be here, so lots of other faculty who studied, and again, historically still a major center for the study of nationalism. So that's why I came to the LSE. Then I stayed on for my PhD, as Ken said, and I still am here today. And so what I want to do now is talk a little bit more about the contribution some of these people have made, right, to the subject of nationalism. This reminds me a bit of Anthony's lectures when I first came here as a master's student. This is his main focus, was talking about theories of nationalism. I don't believe that course still exists, unfortunately. So Anthony really was what he called an ethno-symbolist. He came up with that term himself. I don't think he called it a theory. He called it an approach for what that the differences are quite minor. The point is that he basically tried to talk about origins of national identities and nationalism as an ideology as being rooted to some degree in pre-modern periods or pre-modern eras. But that made him a bit unusual. The most of the literature on nationalism really is what we might call a modernist approach. Modernist meaning it's a study which emphasizes modern changes in society, which generates the advent and the birth of nationalism and national identities in the modern period. I'll talk about Gellner in a minute. The other ones I want to mention just in passing, we have arguments from people like Andreas Wimmer, sociologist who's written about how public goods, people are providing public goods, and that generates inclusion among different ethnic groups, which generates a sense of national identity. We have an institutionalist argument associated more with Brubaker and Roeder, where institutions, modern states have institutions, and those generate incentives for identification and secession. And perhaps most famously is Benedict Anderson's work on imagined communities. I say most famously. I had a chat with John Burley a number of years ago, who I mentioned on the previous slide, and we both thought that the number of citations that Benedict Anderson has received or his book, Imagined Communities, was very high, and so I decided to investigate that as a blog post. This is about 10 years ago. And I wrote a blog post about what was the most cited books in social science, and Anderson's book is fifth on that list, higher than anything by Marx or Foucault or John Rawls. And it's largely because of the title itself. It's very, very well known, Imagined Communities. His argument in that book is about the rise of print media, which allows people to imagine themselves as members of a nation. Right. But as I said, the one I want to talk about today and what I want to use as part of my explanation or my investigation into nationalism in Africa is about Gellner. So this is Gellner's book from 1983. Again, in my opinion, the best book ever written on nationalism. What does Gellner do in the book? He sets forward a very straightforward, very clear argument where he talks about how modernization, especially industrialization, generates national identities. So we can think about this in a very broad structural sense. We have pre-industrial or agrarian economies, which are basically stratified whereby people, their livelihoods are attached to their ethnic identities. We have sort of ethnic-specific capital. Members of one group are better at producing something. Members of another group are better at producing something else. Right? That could be one group is better at farming, one group is better at herding cattle. They farm different crops, etc. So people are largely isolated from each other and are stratified. But what happens is you get a structural transformation, according to Gellner, when you see industrialization, and that generates broader identity formation. For Gellner, the key mechanism, though, when you get industrialization, is that it creates incentives for the state, the modern states, to provide a sort of homogeneous, standardized form of education, to allow people to work in the modern economy, to become mobile workers. And he actually, this is a quote from the book, we have an inescapably homogeneous and standardizing educational system. It promotes a new high culture across the state, which creates this occupational mobility. That's the reason why it's created, but a byproduct, arguably, is a sense of national identity. And he puts this at the end of the book. He says, the industrial economy, or the economy, needs this new central culture and the state, and the culture needs the state. Right? So, again, criticism that some people have made, like David Layton, this is very functionalist. I think David calls it functionalism run mad, in the sense the economy needs something. Economies, of course, don't need anything at all. Right? The point is that's the way Gellner phrases it, but he says the incentives are for, we can rephrase that actually, the incentives are for states to provide education, and that education generates a sense of national identity. But the first mover in all this is industrialization. Okay? So what's the evidence for Gellner's theory? So Ken mentioned my book that came out a couple of years ago. You can see here the title is slightly different from the lecture I'm giving today. Right? In that book, the outcome I was looking at was ethnic assimilation, how countries become more ethnically homogenous, how we see ethnic diversity decline. And what's causing that is industrialization. So it's the same sort of causal factor in that book that I'm looking at today, but slightly different outcome. That book, just to summarize that quickly, I do use mixed methods, quantitative and qualitative evidence. The qualitative evidence is in part from Africa, including Somalia, which I'll try to come to later, as well as Uganda, as sort of counterexamples. Counterexamples meaning cases where we don't get industrialization, and therefore we don't get homogenization. The positive example is this picture I have from the Botswanan diamond industry. So the counterexample is Botswana. It's a nice coincidence, by the way, Botswana is having a national election today as we speak, I think. Or maybe it's over by now. But the Botswana is a case where we do see large-scale structural transformation via the diamond industry, which generates a broader sense of national identity. Okay, so that's where I'm coming from in terms of that argument I made in that book. There's other evidence, I think, that suggests that Gellner's theory is correct. By the way, so that I did argue in that book that industrialization does generate a sense of broader identity, right? Ethnic diversity goes down with industrialization, but it's not by education. And that's one of the things I'm going to come back to in a minute here. Other literature would suggest perhaps there's a correlation between cash crops and ethnic identification, so people who are still producing agricultural production, agricultural cash crops, still identify with their ethnic group because the idea is that that ethnic-specific capital they have is important to them. They're not really entering the industrial sector. We also have some evidence from Wimmer and others who've written about this. But I think what's interesting is that there's very little actual testing of Gellner's core argument. I think that's a crucial point to say that. And not only testing his argument, I think, in a very specific sense, but also seeing how we could see national identity changing over time, right, should be correlated with evidence for industrialization changing over time as well. Right? One of the points I want to make here is not just Gellner, but modernist theories in general should be and can be tested with contemporary evidence. Right? Pre-modern evidence for contemporary identification, okay, that's more difficult. Again, we can talk about that. But if we say that modern phenomena like industrialization or print capitalism or modern states generate modern identities, then we should see change over time in industrialization and change over time in national identification, right? And that really hasn't been done. Why am I doing this for Africa? Why am I looking at this from an African, specifically looking at this within Africa? One of the reasons, there's two main reasons. The first reason is the actual data that we have is actually really, really interesting. So we have, some of you may know, the Afrobarometer Project, which has been created by political scientists across the world. It's centered at Cape Town in South Africa, but also in Ghana and other and Michigan State in the US. Started in the 1990s, has generated now 9 rounds of data. A new round is started every 2 or 3 years across more than 30 countries in Africa. 7 of those rounds, we have a question that they ask people called the Lince-Morino question. It's called the Lince-Morino question. Those are 2 Spanish political scientists who came up with this question. It's about, do you identify more with your subnational identity or more with your national identity? Now, again, I said Spanish political scientists. It's not an accident that they came up with that, because it's used originally to study this debate in Spain between Catalan versus Spanish identity, or Basque versus Spanish identity. And in this country, it's often used to study Scottish versus British identity, and sometimes as well English or Welsh identity versus British identity, right? So a subnational versus a national identity. I should say as well, this is it's a very interesting question in terms of surveys. It's sadly the only survey, cross-national survey, that actually uses this question, right? Other parts of the world, other kind of survey instruments either don't ask a question about national identity, or they use a question about national pride. Are you proud of your nation? Are you proud to be X? Are you proud to be Argentinian or Ghanaian or Indian, right? Now, again, we can talk about that as a meaningful sense of how that generates a meaning, measures national identity in a meaningful way. One of the problems with that, of course, is that the vast majority of people always say that they're proud, right? That it doesn't vary much over time, and it doesn't even vary much over space. Usually 80, 90% of people in these surveys always say that they're proud to be a member of something, right? What's interesting about the Lince-Morino question, as I said, it actually asks you to compare A against B. You're comparing these 2 types of identities to each other. So I'll show you in a minute, you actually do get significant variation across space within African countries, and you get variation over time. As I said, it also captures, I think, a very meaningful element of what it means to be a member of a nation. You think back to the theories I just mentioned, you think back to Gellner and others, right? We think that national identities are actually formed or created as people re-identify from a smaller group to a larger group. My favorite example here is anecdotal, it's from Europe, is the German national anthem. For those who know, the original words of the German national anthem, the starting line is Deutschland über alles in der Welt, Germany above everything else in the world. The Nazis took that phrase to literally mean above everything else in the whole world. But that was not the original meaning. It actually meant above, identify with being German above identifying as being Prussian or Bavarian or Badish or subnational identities, right? So it is a very clear example of how you're supposed to identify with the nation above these subnational identities, right? So now we have a lot of evidence, we have a lot of surveys, which means we can actually track changes over time. We can actually compare changes over time within countries for the first time as of just a few years ago within Africa, okay? And a lot of observations from over 30 countries, okay? A large number of countries in Africa. This is an example of what the questions look like, okay? So we have, again, I only feel subnational, more subnational than national, equally subnational, or more national than subnational and only national, right? 5 different categories. And what's interesting is we can also vary how we measure this as a outcome or dependent variable. We can say, okay, you're more national than ethnic, or you flip it around and saying I'm more ethnic than national. And you can also just focus on the national identity part, just this last fifth answer that you can give. There's some debate about how we should interpret this middle category, by the way. It's not a perfect instrument. The middle category could be that you really, really care passionately about both your ethnic or national identity, or you just don't care about either of them, right? It's hard to track exactly what that is. Anyway, so has existed for a number of years now, the Afrobarometer question, and it's generated a very interesting literature from within political science and economics. Some of you will be familiar with this. We have some literature. Again, I've contributed to this here at the LSE. Tim Bestley has done some work on this as well, saying that there's historical conflict in Africa generates lower levels of national identity. Alarup et al. Say that there's a link between GDP per capita, which I'll come back to. This is, again, cross-sectional. This is not change over time. This is just looking across space. We also have interesting work on historical independent variables, historical meaning, determinants of national identity that happened before the surveys were done. Again, I won't go into detail, but one thing I'll mention is Carlett's paper, co-authored with another LSE graduate, Amit Marjaria, written about Tanzania. I mentioned that in passing because that's an interesting case where they're looking at the effect of the Ujamaa policy, a villagization that took place after independence in Tanzania, and they argue that that Ujamaa policy under Julius Nyerere, villagization has had a positive effect on people's identification with the Tanzanian nation. Tanzania is often talked about as a case study of high levels of national identity in Africa. And lastly, I'll talk about, I'll just mention in passing here, right, we have various time-varying determinants, meaning, again, changes over time within countries is generating changes over time in national identity. A bunch of literature. I'll mention in passing my favorite paper here. Some of you know this paper from Emilio de Petres Chauvin from Chile. Wrote a paper on football matches. And I love that paper because what he shows in the paper is that if you have a survey that's taking place during a period where there's a football match, I say national football match, you know, like especially if countries are playing in the World Cup or they're playing in the Africa Cup of Nations, if your team, this is again like Ghana versus Togo or something, right? If your team wins, you're more likely to identify with your national identity after the match. Right? Not if they lose, but only if they win. And he also shows in that paper that he and his co-authors show as well that there's actually a decline in violence in terms of intercommunal violence or civil war violence in these countries as well. And again, we smile at that, but this literature is growing. It's large and it's growing, and I think it suggests that there's meaningful evidence here of identification that actually is not just something that people answer on a survey, but actually has real-world implications. So coming back to my second reason for focusing on Africa, it's not just the data. It's also that we have a period of industrialization taking place in Africa. Okay? So African states become independent in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s. There's certainly a drive among these states, the leaders of these states. I already mentioned Julius Nyerere, among others, in Africa, in Tanzania, but other leaders in Africa really feel a need to focus on homogenizing these states. And here's where I think there's a lot of analogies we can make with an earlier period in European history. Right? We think about this literature I mentioned before, the theoretical literature on the origins of national identity, and that literature really focused on 19th century, early 20th century European states, right? The birth of a nationalism in France and Germany and Britain and Spain, etc. If you compare some of these states in the 19th century to states today or late 20th century, right, you see very similar ideas. For instance, this is a famous quote from one of the founding fathers of Italy. Italy was unified in 1860. Very famous quote from Massimo D'Alessio, "We have Italy, now we must make Italians." Right? So there's the idea that we have to create a sense of Italian national identity. You compare that to one of many, many quotes from post-colonial African leaders. You have Samora Machel, president of Mozambique, the late president of Mozambique, saying, "For the nation to live, the tribe must die." Very, very similar, arguably. Right? Again, we need to create a sense of national identity. So that's part of the process, and one of the things I'll talk about today is how we have African leaders who are promoting a sense of national identity. We also have evidence that these countries, these African states, in many ways are comparable to European states. They have diversity. We have linguistic, ethnic diversity in Europe at this moment. We have it in Africa as well. What makes Africa and Europe similar in some ways and makes them other parts of the world dissimilar is that, for instance, we have in India, we have a caste system which is attached to occupational groups historically that doesn't really exist in Africa. In some select cases, it does, maybe Rwanda, Burundi, parts of West Africa, but basically doesn't exist. And we also don't get, in Latin America, we get this strong indigenous or immigrant divides, right, and mestizo concepts, again, doesn't really exist in that sense in Africa, with the exception of South Africa. So we have similarities there. We also have similarities in terms of industrialization. I'll come back to this in a minute, but one thing we would say is that we have low levels of industrialization in 19th century Europe, and we have low levels of industrialization in post-colonial Africa, and in both cases, they rise over time. So first thing I'm going to show you is a measure of industrialization, which is my favorite measure of industrialization, which is carbon emissions per capita. I think carbon emissions per capita really captures what it means to be an industrial country. I say carbon emissions specifically. I'm not talking about global greenhouse gases in general, right? We know that methane, for instance, is often produced by agricultural production, but carbon emissions very much is associated with industrialization. And here what I've done is I've compared Italy and Nigeria. Very nicely, Nigeria becomes independent exactly 100 years after Italy is unified. And I'm starting the clock in both cases when they are unified or independent. And this is carbon emissions on the vertical axis. And Italy is in orange, Nigeria is in blue. And you see here, of course, there's lots of ups and downs, right? Italy looks a bit more smooth in part because it's a historical data that has to be reconstructed. But you basically see about 30, 40, 50 years after independence, they have about the same level of carbon emissions per capita, right? Both going up. Again, we have this period where Nigeria goes up and then down, but generally increasing over time in similar ways. That is not just cherry-picked, right? There's other countries we can compare. Here, I'm taking two more countries from Europe that became independent in the early 20th century. That's Norway and Bulgaria. And we compare them to two African countries which became independent in the late 20th century, Botswana and Mauritius. Here, it's not Nigeria going up and down, it's Norway which is going up and down. Bulgaria is more smooth. But what's interesting is they all are increasing, they're all overlapping, right? By the way, the numbers you can see here are higher than Nigeria or Italy. The point is that industrialization, at least in this measure, is proceeding. In some cases, Botswana and Mauritius, two of the more successful countries in Africa in terms of levels of industrialization. But certainly, and you can see here among this chart, at least in this point, Mauritius is higher than any of these other three countries, right, in terms of its carbon emissions. Mauritius being a very good example of a country in Africa which has managed to industrialize and urbanize and actually generate high levels of GDP growth. So that is, again, two reasons why I focused on Africa. So how do I measure an industrialization? I'm not going to go into details in terms of the analysis. I'm just going to show you some scatter plots. Well, how do we measure an industrialization? One thing I should mention is there is a tendency in a lot of the literature, including major authors like Danny Roderick, who's I've seen him speak on this stage at least twice, to confuse manufacturing and industrialization. Manufacturing, of course, is a major component within industrialization. But it's not the entire component, right? When we talk about a change from an agrarian to an industrial society, that does involve manufacturing, but it really involves a transfer of employment and economic focus out of agriculture and agrarian production towards industrial production, which can include construction, it can include mining, which I'll talk about in a minute, and eventually into a services economy, right? So that is not the same thing. What we can say in terms of how we measure industrialization, we can talk about, as I mentioned, carbon emissions per capita. So that's the emissions data for global atmospheric research, is Edgar. GDP per capita is one slightly problematic measure of industrialization. I do think it captures a lot of that. Of course, we know that countries, when they sell things like oil, their GDP per capita goes up and down depending on the global price for that product. But it is, I think, a good measure. We have energy consumption. This is from the U.S. Energy Administration. Again, captures, I think, a lot of the industrial production that takes place in the modern world. And, of course, we can think about employment. In this case, we would call it non-agricultural employment data from the Afrobarometer itself. There's other measures that we can talk about. Cement production is also a wonderful measure of industrialization, by the way. But here's what I want to show you. Again, I'll just skip this because I don't want to go into detail in terms of the analysis, but I'm happy to answer that more in Q&A. This is to show you just a scatter plot. Each observation, each dot here, is a country in a given round of the Afrobarometer. Okay? So we have a proportion of people who are identifying more with their national identity than with not identifying with a national identity, right? So people who are 0.3, meaning there's a much higher proportion of people identifying with their nation than not identifying with the nation. Horizontal axis, we have the carbon emissions per capita. What you can see here is obviously there's no relationship, right? This is just a scatter plot. This is not saying anything about change over time. This is my point. We have literature which is doing a lot of this work, looking at tracking, looking at a cross-sectional relationship. But ultimately, what we should be viewing is when there is an increase, when there is a change in industrialization, we should also see a change in national identification. So here's what I do instead. The next graph, I'm going to show you change from two rounds. So between, say, rounds 3 and 5 or 4 and 6, et cetera, and in terms of carbon emissions, and also change in national identification between across two rounds. So each observation on the next slide is a country with a change over time in two rounds. So here, all of a sudden, we start to see there is a positive relationship. And I've drawn a line there for the line of best fit. This is carbon emissions data. Again, each observation is a change between two rounds by country. This is GDP per capita. Again, we see an upward sloping curve. This is primary energy production. And here is non-agricultural employment. Again, not a perfect measure, I admit. We don't actually have good data on what sector of the economy people are working in, but I can say these are people who are not working in agriculture and that they are actually working. So people who are not employed, people who are not housewives or housemakers, and people who are not students. Right? So here again, small number of observations, but the same general trend. Right? So here we see evidence, and again, I have more detailed evidence if you want me to talk about it. But we have evidence here that there's a growing amount of industrialization is generating growing amount of national identification. Now again, recall, what did Gellner say? He said industrialization should have an effect on national identity. But he said the mechanism was via education. Now if you look at education, we find basically no relationship. This is again, the measure I have here is people who have more than a primary school level of education in these surveys. There's no real evidence that increasing education is generating more national identification. So in other words, we have what I'm trying to show here, what I think the evidence suggests, is that there is a direct relationship between industrialization and national identification, not what Gellner says. So he's right. He said right in the sense there's a link between industrialization and national identification, but not for the reasons he suggested. Not for the reason, not for the mechanism that he suggested. Now, and again, in my book, I talked about Gellner as a serious theorist who suggests that industrialization generates a form of homogenization. He was explicit about writing about national identity. The other author, which is going back 150 years, was Karl Marx. Karl Marx did not write about national identity. He wrote about class formation, right? And that's not what I'm talking about today. I'm not claiming any theory of class formation or evidence for class formation. What was interesting about Marx's theory and Gellner's theory is they're very similar. They're both talking about structural transformation generating identity formation. And for Marx, it's a direct relationship. Gellner is via education. But Marx is very much about how classes are formed as people leave the countryside, they come together, they form common bonds amongst each other, and they identify with a larger group. Again, classes, not for nations. But that's what Marx said, and perhaps it's a little bit similar to what I'm saying here, at least in terms of the direct relationship. Let me talk a little bit about a case study, a positive case study, a negative case study, then I'll conclude. Positive case study. Interesting case study because it's one of the poorest countries in the world. It's a country which historically and today is still extremely poor country in the Sahel, probably the poorest region of the world, and that's Burkina Faso. What's happened in Burkina Faso in the last couple of decades is quite interesting, and that's the birth of a gold industry. So previously had basically no gold industry 20 years ago, and very recently has seen rapid growth in its gold industry and gold mining to become the fourth largest gold producer in Africa and the 13th largest in the world. And it's possibly this year will overtake Mali to become the third largest after South Africa and Ghana. It earns revenues from two ways. One is industrial mining. Another way is through ASM, that's artisanal and small-scale mining. The more money comes from the industrial mining, but more employment comes from the ASM. And there is evidence from recent papers from economics that we have seen production generating declining poverty, increasing living standards, increasing household expenditures, but possibly generating some increased amount of child labor, increased amount of inequality. I mention that because what I've just said, you know, if you were to write this about mid-19th century England, that's exactly what you would have said as well. This fits into a sort of story you might tell for an early industrializer. Right? We know child labor was very common in this country. We know with this rising inequality in early industrialization, periods of early industrialization, and Burkina Faso fits in, to some degree into this story. I'm not going to claim that everything is peachy keen and very nice, and Burkina Faso has an ongoing problem with Islamist insurgency, not just in Burkina, but across the Sahel region. It also has a lot of political instability. It had two coups d'etat in 2002. The current president, Traoré, has been in power for 2 years. I think there's been no elections and has no plans to have election anytime soon. Here's what the gold production looks like, just out of interest. You see it overtaking Tanzania and Mali, starting from basically nothing in 2001. This is tons, metric tons of gold produced per year. This is where the production is taking place. This is a map you see in red, is Burkina Faso. This whole area of West Africa has lots of gold production right now. It's called the Birimian Belt. Claims that I think it's now the second most important site for gold production in the world outside South Africa. I want to just show you as well, I know it's complicated, that basically it's the yellow and green bits where there's lots of gold mining. What's interesting is you look at the map of Burkina Faso, and most of the country is covered by this map. There's gold production across the entire country. Why is that important? Is that, again, relates back to our thinking about how industrialization proceeds and how it can often generate conflict. And in fact, Gellner writes about this in his book. One of the middle chapters, he talks about this imaginary example of megalomania and Ruritania. And he talks about how the problems of uneven industrialization generate secessionist tendencies for this Ruritanian periphery, right? So in other words, uneven industrialization generates inequality and generates tension. Here in Burkina Faso, we see mining across the country. It's not really concentrated in one area. Mali, by the way, does have concentration, right? Mali also has lots of instability right now. Ghana has uneven distribution of gold mining as well, right? So that's interesting already that we have relatively equitably distributed gold sites across Burkina Faso. This is what it looks like, by the way. This is the industrial sector mining, picture of an industrial mine, and this is what it looks like, the ASM, much more low-key and low technology. In terms of the data, this is just to show you what it looks like. Here we have rising national identification over time in Burkina Faso. Here we have declining ethnic identification over time. This is data from the Afrobarometer. I put up some measures of industrialization. Here, this is carbon emissions rising over time. Again, this is the number here is actually, for carbon emissions, that actually is the number in terms of tons per capita. Here is GDP rising over time. This is actually proportion, as you see here, proportion of the sub-Saharan African average GDP. So rising GDP, not just in absolute terms, but relative to other parts of Africa. And here is declining agricultural employment. It's quite shocking, actually, quite impressive. This is for women, and this is for men. This is not from the Afrobarometer. This is declining levels of agricultural employment, proportion of people working in agriculture. Here is data from the Afrobarometer, also declining. So this is, seems to be suggestive evidence that we're seeing increased industrialization, declining employment in agriculture is associated, in this case, with increased national identity. Here, by the way, is education, right? Not much increase in education. We still have only about 25% of the people in these surveys in Burkina Faso who claim to have more than a primary school education. Very low. Again, some of the lowest levels of education in the world that you'll find in this region, in the Sahel region in Africa. But we're seeing increased national identification. Again, evidence, perhaps, that this is industrialization is generating this change, but not education per se. So one of these questions is, am I talking about industrialization? Is this really industrialization? Is this just people going off to a mine and doing gold mining and not really entering a sort of sectoral transformation? That is a literature that has been suggested before. Hans Singer older economist from the 1950s, claimed that mining was very much an enclave economy, separate from the rest of the economy. Is that true? Debatable. Perhaps then, I'm not sure. It is still true today. We think about, to use Albert Hirschman's term, I'm sure Ken is happy about that, we go talk about backward and forward linkages, right? The idea that forward linkages to some degree exist with gold. It's really more the backward linkages are important. In other words, the inputs that people use in terms of hoes and mining equipment and buckets and spades and all these things you use in ASM as well as in the industrial sector mining, that tends to be generated locally. So there is a big influence perhaps that mining could have on industrialization. We also have evidence, of course, that mining played a major role in industrialization in Europe, and also perhaps played a major role as well in national identity formation. We think about parts of the Ruhr Valley in Germany or the Donbass region of Ukraine, in Wales, South Wales, Belgium, Bohemia, all major industrial sites where mining was very important. This is coal mining in particular, which perhaps has more forward linkages than gold mining, but also areas which there's lots of evidence that these are areas which saw very strong attachments to a broader sense of national identity. Within Africa, the most obvious comparator in this sense is South Africa. Right? Here we've seen gold and diamond mining. Here there's evidence that people from all across South Africa came together to work on these gold and diamond mines, late 19th, early 20th century. What happened here is people came from all parts of South Africa. They were forced onto these mines by the white land mine owners. And evidence that there was a, quote, fusion of hitherto antagonistic tribes. That was the concern by mine owners, that people were coming together, creating labor unions, and forming broader senses of identity that threatened white rule and led directly to the establishment of the apartheid regime in the 1940s. Right? So the idea was that these miners were coming together, forming a broader sense of identity. The whites were worried about that, and that is exactly why we saw the system of apartheid gradually set up over a matter of decades. Contrasting example, I'm going to say this and then I'll conclude. A contrasting example, which unfortunately is not just one country, but several countries within Africa, is a case study of Somalia. I mentioned Somalia. That's a case study I talked about in my book. It's an interesting case study because, it, as I said towards the beginning of the lecture, Somalia is one of many examples of African countries which focus very heavily on nation building through policies, through government policies, trying to generate a broad sense of national identity. One of many phrases that Siad Barre, he was the president of Somalia in 1969 to 1991, tribalism divides, socialism unites. He outlawed, I think there was a phrase people used to say in Somalia where people would say, what is your tribe, as a way of greeting someone, and he outlawed that. He also had a famous occasion in 1971, he called the Somali National Clanism Funeral Day, where he went to the main football stadium and symbolically buried tribes in the football stadium. Right? Some of those are more silly, some of them are important. He led a massive literacy campaign in the 1970s, which generated huge increases in literacy in Somalia. This is actually quite impressive, but very little focus on economic production and economic transformation. Right? Very little interest in actually transforming the Somali economy. Very interestingly, similar in many ways to Botswana. The saying that I've heard before, which I like, is kind of Botswana is like Somalia, but with diamonds. Right? So he didn't have diamonds. He didn't have any attempts to generate economic transformation. Traditionally would have been camel herding and sheep herding, among others. Very still focused on an agrarian sector. Industrial production, this is from a World Bank paper from 1984, said industrial production was possibly the lowest in the entire world at this point, 80 U.S. cents per capita. Basically, that meant that people still maintained their relations with their clans because they had not entered the modern economy. They used those clan relations as a social safety net. And then what happened is when things started spiraling out of control in Somalia, we got this interstate war with Ethiopia, led to civil war, the collapse of the Somali state in the 1990s. And still today, we talk about clan identity being extremely important in Somali politics, whether in Somaliland or in Somalia. So that's a case study where we have attempts at nation building, but we don't get industrialization, and therefore we don't get a very strong sense of national identity. So to conclude, what I've said here is today is I've tried to talk about why I think industrialization generates a strong sense of national identification within the African context. I think it relates back to an older literature on Europe, which says very similar things for events that might have happened 200 years ago. It adds to growing relevance, a literature on the growing relevance of industrialization in the role of economic development more broadly. I mentioned Chang, as in Hajun Chang, professor at SOAS down the road, among others who talk about how within development studies, and again, I'm not saying anything new here, within development studies, we've had perhaps lost focus on industrialization as a major component in development. Chang has said we've lost focus, not to blame a focus on poverty, which has been very important, I think, in and human development in the last, say, 50 years, but certainly compared to the post-World War II era in the 50s and 60s when industrialization was really, really important, I think, in development. There's been a decline in interest, perhaps, from within developing countries as well as from the global north. And I think Chang has a nice phrase. He says, not talking about industrialization is talking about development without development. So here, again, why industrialization is important. As well as another thing that I've said today is perhaps suggesting that structural transformation, industrialization, the changes in economic structures in a country have serious political or social implications in terms of national identity, and perhaps is more important than a lot of these government policies we talk about. I gave the example of Somalia. I can talk about other examples of countries in Africa and elsewhere who really work hard to generate a broader sense of identity, but when they don't couple that with a focus on economic transformation, perhaps those policies don't tend to work. Again, I'm not saying this is always true. The case of Tanzania may be a counterexample. Again, I'm slightly unconvinced about Tanzania. This is a country which has not seen economic transformation, yet does seem to register high levels of national identity. But that's still under debate. I mentioned Skolnick. I'm not trying to criticize other authors too much. I just mentioned that as an example of a book which came out recently about Gellner's work and didn't have a single chapter on it about industrialization. Right? And I think that's key when we think about how industrialization has a big impact on nationalism to keep that Gellner's work in mind in that sense. Lastly, and then I'll stop, is to talk about, end on a positive note. Right? I said we have Somalia, we have other examples where there's perhaps a negative suggestion that industrialization is not transforming African states, but it, I think, has transformed countries like Botswana, Mauritius. Perhaps it's in the initial stages of transforming a country like Burkina Faso. And what's interesting is when I first started working on Africa 20 years ago, the big sort of literature from the 80s and 90s was very pessimistic, sort of Afro-pessimism, right, based to some degree on the Africa's lost decade in the 1980s and the 1990s when Africa, many African states suffered huge amounts of economic decline and conflict and civil war and even genocide in Rwanda, right? So people were very pessimistic about the future of African nationalism. And many people suggested, for instance, Herbst, so Smith, I mentioned, wrote a book, Anthony Smith, who was here, wrote a book on African nationalism, the problems of African nationalism, how impossible or difficult it was. Herbst was very famous for writing about how we need to break up African states. Clearly, they're not working. We need to redraw their borders. And lastly, Basil Davidson wrote a book. The title says it all. It was called The Black Man's Burden, Africa and the Curse of the Nation State. In other words, nation states are not suitable for Africa. We tried to impose nation states in Africa, and they simply can't work. So I think that was wrong. I think it is wrong. I think the evidence has changed since then in the last 30, 40 years that suggests perhaps that actually African states are developing a sense of national identity. And in part, in large part, I think that's because of things like industrialization. Thank you for listening. I'll stop there, and I'd be happy to take your questions.
Hi, I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ asks social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or, can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
Thank you very much, Dr. Green, for that. That was a fascinating more understanding of economics in across the African continent. But I'm a little confused by it. Obviously, the borders in Africa are artificial, and because of the Berlin conference. But unlike Europe, I don't think I've ever heard of an African version of the Westphalian Treaty. And how does the BRICS organization figure into the national or subnational identity of the African continent?
Thank you very much. Very interesting talk. I appreciate the nuance that you added at the end of your talk as well. As you were going through your talk, you spoke about Botswana, and instantly what came to my mind is that, oh, they didn't industrialize. And then you mentioned the mines, and I was like, oh, he thought about that. And then you continued by saying that that led to a good substratum of economic work that you can base the nationalism of. And then I thought about Sierra Leone, how there's 16 ethnicities, 16 languages, but English somehow seems to be the tying language. And then in your analysis, when you disprove Gellner's logic through education, I don't know if I've expressed that correctly, you omit primary education, which to me sent alarm bells ringing, because precisely in Botswana, which is the case that you cite, Setswana was taught in primary school, and that was the tool for nationalism. And I thought about Tanzania, which is another example that you mentioned, and the Uyama policies. I just read a book by a Kenyan author which talks about child's experiences, and talk about the fact that, you know, Swahili was also a very strong tying factor that allowed for national identity to arise within East Africa. So my question basically goes to say, in omitting primary education from your disapproval of Gellner's analysis, are you not maybe taking away from precisely the point that allowed these countries to unite? Because we know language is such a strong part of national identity. So is it maybe a combination of your theory, Gellner's, and Anderson's?
Can you handle one more? Or do you want
yes,
to those
that's
two?
That's yeah. fine. No, that's okay.
The blue shirt right there. Yeah, right there.
Thank you. So my, again, it feeds into his question about education and how do we contextualize it in African example. So I'm from Ghana, and I was thinking about Gellner's, how Gellner constructed it. And in a sense, it kind of fits in the Ghanaian example, even though you can take away industrialization. So I think one of the inadvertent effects of colonial institutions in Ghana, i.e. the boarding schools, has been to foster some sense of like national identity. That is my estimation. And a number of Ghanaians do share the idea that because you have people from northern Ghana, eastern, western, different classes, all coming to public boarding schools, and these boarding schools are seen as prestigious, even though maybe they are underfunded, you see a situation where people in like the higher classes, some of them are very happy to take their children to boarding schools. There's a sense of national unity, sort of, or national identification. People, in a sense, do identify. I think boarding schools have like fostered that. And also another like example being national service, where you've historically have had people moving from other places to go live in other places. You see a lot of it in Nigeria. How do we explain how like some of these colonial institutions, i.e., education and national service, has fostered national identity if we are going to disprove Gellner?
Okay, thank you. Three wonderful questions. I'll start with the first one, the gentleman here. That's a wonderful question. You're absolutely right. So we think about, to use a more technical term, we think about state formation in Europe as endogenous. As they are basically Europeans are participating in state formation. In Africa, Africans largely did not participate, right? These are colonial, as you mentioned, right? This is the idea. We have Treaty of Berlin, we have Europeans carving up Africa and creating these borders. The Africans themselves are not creating these borders, right? So that is, you're right, it's an absolutely key major difference, with some small exceptions, but basically that's right. Now, that was, this is, again, going back to the literature I mentioned at the end of the lecture. In some ways, that's the argument, is that Europeans created these artificial states. Africans are stuck with these artificial states. They don't make any sense, right? We should redraw borders. we should cancel this colonial constructs and just allow Africans to create new borders. Now, again, the argument against that, first of all, is that how do you do that? Right? Herbst would have said, you just draw the borders according to where actually people control these territories. We know the DRC in particular, Democratic Republic of Congo, has had a long history of not really controlling its own territory. Somalia, still today, is not really, the government does not control its own territory. But in other cases, that is the recipe for civil war. It's a recipe for huge amounts of population movement and complete mess. One argument, which I think is very persuasive, is that we say, okay, these states were created artificially. Central African Republic, Ghana, Botswana, these have no history as along these borders in a pre-colonial world. But we have these states today, and we can make them work. We can form a sense of identity within these borders. We have something in common. We can generate this identity over time. And football, among other things, that can help form this identity. And I think that's interesting because we think of the analogy someone has made. Again, not a perfect analogy, but not all states in Europe are like that. Not all states were formed through endogenous means. We have states that were like Belgium, right, that were created in the 19th century. Belgium is a 19th century creation, right? Greece, modern Greece, is a 19th century creation, right? We have various other states that are actually quite recent in Europe, and they as well, again, Belgium, not perfect example, but you'd say a lot of these states have a sense of national identity, and they formed it over many decades. So I think the potential there is also true for Africa. As I said, this is where I remain a sort of Afro-optimist rather than Afro-pessimist. Question about language. Yes, I think, I will not say language has no effect on national identity. Schooling language has no effect. I think that's too strong. But I think that perhaps Gellner's argument, I find, the evidence is less persuasive. For the focus on language and schooling. We have, this relates back to this gentleman's point as well. In fact, I'll answer the two questions together. National service, there is evidence for national service. There's some recent papers from economics which seems to suggest, from Ghana and Nigeria, I think I've seen in economics journals, suggesting that national service does generate a broader sense of identity and also perhaps is associated with interethnic marriage in countries like Ghana and Nigeria. There's a but coming in. The but is that one sociologist based in Canada, Matthew Lang, wrote a book a number of years ago talking about the link between education and ethnic conflict. And his argument was that there is, to some degree, a glass ceiling effect. Right? Education is great at bringing people together. Perhaps you're generating a sense of identity through schooling. But what happens with education is that you educate people in a context where they're not getting good jobs, and they become frustrated. And to some degree, that will spill out into intercommunal or interethnic violence. And so there's not a straightforward relationship whereby education necessarily generates a broader sense of identity. It can, I think, in certain contexts, but it also can generate the opposite to some degree. Yeah. So more. Sorry? So I didn't understand that question. Yeah, I mean, well, this is still a question to what degree we're seeing changes in international relations as countries in the global south move away from their association with the former colonial powers, right? And they formed the new organizations, also within Africa, of course, you see new regional blocs forming, which is quite interesting. You can also talk about transnational identities. If you want to talk about an East African identity, I mean, that's interesting to talk about, whether there's West African or East African or Southern African identities, to some degree, those are also consequences of transnational or regional cooperation movements. So that's possible, yeah. Okay. I'll take more questions.
Laura?
Thank you, Elliot. So my question is about sort of your definition, is this industrialization? And I'm a little unclear what you mean by that, because at the beginning you talked about it not being about manufacturing, but then towards the end in your conclusions when you were talking about Chang and the importance of production, you kind of went back to manufacturing. And in terms of the kind of variables you're using, like I was just off the top of my head thinking about industrialization measures, I would think about like manufacturing value added, right. Although maybe you don't agree with that, but like carbon emissions and GDP, like are you talking more about growth? Because I also think that the nature of industrialization is changing over the course of your cases, that in European countries, it was industrialization within a world that wasn't competitive, partly because your cases are empires, like destroying industrialization of other parts of the world, whereas modern industrialization is much more unbundled, and you know there are global value chains, and it's totally changed like the opportunities for economic growth that developing countries are trying to integrate into. So I wondered if you could talk a little bit like more specifically what you think are the kind of specific aspects of industrialization that you think are having these changes. That would be helpful. Thanks.
Right here.
Yeah, Tanzania. I remember you mentioned this being one that they managed to industrialize, but without developing kind of a widespread national identity. I wondered why you think that is, and also, do you think that maybe that this theory that everyone's trying to prove or disprove can work backwards? Like, can industrialization bring about a shared national identity through mobility and, you know, eventual just dilution of tribal values and that connection that you feel to people in your tribe just because you're spread out over more space now and you just have bigger concerns?
What was the case you mentioned?
Tanzania, I think.
Tanzania.
Pass
the mic to the guy right next to you, please. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your speech and your time. I wanted to ask a question regarding some effects of some projects related to the Belt and Road Initiative. I don't know enough about those, so please correct me if I get anything wrong, but I remember there was this landmark case, I think, in Ethiopia, where they financed some railways projects, and they came in and brought the capital, they brought the materials, they brought the labor as well. And after the project was over, the capital had been invested, the railway was built, but also the people remained. And so there was this dream that, well, China would invest in the country and bring jobs, but actually these jobs went to Chinese people that actually remained in the country, potentially unemployed. So I wanted to ask if these situations, if they're factually correct, please correct me on this, could help or did help the country, how can I say, get together against the immigrant, which is something that has happened in Europe, or, well, how it played out in the end. Thank you.
Yep. I'm going to tag on one more just from the internet world, whatever the
okay. Ethernet.
Sorry, I sound ancient there. But it's just a very quick question that somebody asked, and they wanted to know if you have in your research collected any data on Algeria, an African country where there's sort of large tensions and interplay between national and local identities. We could just sort of toss that into the mix.
Yeah. All right. Thank you all. Again, wonderful questions. I'll start out with Laura's question on manufacturing. Yes, I admit you caught me there. I did sort of switch back to Chang. And, of course, Chang talks about manufacturing. Yeah, absolutely right. But let me just repeat again. I think Hirschman even talks about this, too. Like, we have backwards forward linkages. And Hirschman talks about, I think, fiscal linkages as well. Right? We talk about when we have a product like gold, where you have mining or diamonds in the case of South Africa and other cases, you sell that product abroad, you generate tax revenue, and you can use that tax revenue to invest in manufacturing. That's to some degree what happened in South Africa, right? You can generate, again, I'm not saying that South Africa is an exemplar of a country which has fully modernized or at least, industrialized. It has huge problems with its economy, including large-scale inequality and large-scale unemployment. But the point is that you can generate, by selling things like gold abroad, you can actually generate that fiscal revenue that can allow you to invest in manufacturing. To jump into the Burkina case, what's interesting, by the way, in Burkina is, like I said, very early stages. What's happened literally just a few weeks ago. So part of the issue is it suffers a lot from this Islamist insurgency, which is, across the Sahel. It's not specifically Burkina. But the government recently talked about nationalizing certain mines and taking them off the hands of foreign mine owners, in part because they want to increase production, right? And that's, I wouldn't go so far as to say this is an example of an industrial strategy, but it is the case where the government is actually trying to actively pursue some sort of control over the mining and actually start taxing it. One of the problems I didn't have time to mention, Burkina has had a huge amount of problem of smuggling. One of the biggest exporters of gold to Europe in West Africa is Togo. Togo has no gold mines at all. This is all Burkina gold, which is being smuggled across the border and then back up into Switzerland or wherever, right? So this is this suggests perhaps that there's, yes, absolutely manufacturing should be part of the story, and you do see some of this, right? Again, our colleague Kate Meager has written about this in informal economies and informal manufacturing in West Africa. There's certainly potential for that in these countries. I think that all I'm trying to say is manufacturing is not the end-all deal. It's part of the story. Question about Tanzania. So Tanzania is, again, it's a fascinating country where you would say you might get the generation of a national identity without a form of industrialization. Tanzania is still very poor, does not really, it has, as I mentioned, has some gold mining, but really no evidence of structural transformation. This paper I mentioned about the effect of Ujamaa, I think that's interesting. It shows perhaps that these policies after independence perhaps generated some level of national identity, but only for a short period, right? This is only during the period where you have this villagization policy taking place. And after that, the country started to have a huge amount of economic decline. Nyerere stepped down, and Tanzania did not pursue any more sort of broad structural changes in its economy, right? It's really seen very low levels of growth since then. So you could argue, yes, it's a case where the government has made a difference in terms of promoting a broad sense of identity through education, perhaps, or through villagization. But it's also a country where, because it couldn't generate continued growth, that came to an end, right? These policies came to an end. And so that, again, suggests these African states, which don't generate GDP growth, which don't generate export revenues, are kind of unable to continue pursuing these kind of policies. Ethiopia. Yeah, I mean, I would love to, I should mention the Afrobarometer data. I didn't mention the countries included. And that goes to the Algeria point, too. Ethiopia and Algeria are not included in this. North African countries, this question is not being asked. And Ethiopia has been surveyed once, and so we don't have any kind of panel data. We don't have data over time. Sorry, I'm talking to you. And that is very fascinating, because if you want to talk about, going back to Laura's question, you want to talk about a country in Africa with very little natural resources, which actually does have a manufacturing sector which is growing, it's Ethiopia, right? Country with over 100 million people. There's a lot of manufacturing growth that's taking place in the last 20 years or so, with high levels of growth, with high levels of conflict as well, I should say, right? So lots of things taking place in Ethiopia. I think there's a lot more potential for work on how that has transformed identities in Ethiopia. Don't forget, of course, Ethiopia is unusual. It has a system of ethnic federalism, which deliberately sort of makes people identify according to their ethnic group. It creates ethnic majorities in certain areas. And so that's perhaps unusual within the African context. But there's a lot more work to be done.
All right, another round.
Woman here in the orange.
Yeah, hi everyone. I just wanted to know if you could speak about identity formation and its links with the rise of property rights, maybe in Africa, especially property rights linked to land, urbanization as well, and in broad sense, war, and how it kind of created this enemy of the outside that might be helped to form national identity.
Yeah. Paul?
Behind you.
Thank you.
And then the next one, the woman over there with the...
Great, thank you, Elliot. So I'm wondering about micro foundations. You have a materialist view of identification, such that what you do economically may cause a shift from an ethnic to a national identity, right? So I'm wondering, what is the micro level mechanisms that might maintain an ethnic identity in a rural or urban area, and then what is the process by which that gets supplanted by a national identity?
Thank you for everyone's questions, and the overall lecture has been great. My question kind of establishes a comparison between the countries, like, for example, the US, where we see that they're using the industry now as part of the protectionism against the first wave of globalization as a channel for banal ways of nationalism, or even more explicit, such as like the Made in the USA stamp. And you mentioned that in Somalia there was a heavy focus on nation building throughout, like through the industry as a channel. And I wanted to ask if this is something that we see across the board, or if the nation building exercise is done through less state-led approaches, and if so, how is it done?
Why don't you hit these, and then we'll do another round.
Okay.
Well, there's probably 15 people having
okay, all right. I'll try to be quick, though. I'm glad there's so many good questions. It's a question on property rights. My quick answer to that is you're asking the wrong LSEID professor. You should be talking to Professor Kathy Boone, who's unfortunately not around now. She's on sabbatical. Has written a whole book on this topic, right? The politics of property rights. I think that's the key thing, though, to remember in the African context, I glossed over this very quickly, is we have why, and it actually comes back to Jean-Paul's question, too, actually. I can answer to some degree at the same time. Why in Africa do we think of ethnic identity as being so important for people historically meaning in the colonial and like post-colonial period, the 20th century, is we think because that allows people to access land, right? The whole point of the way colonialism was set up among the British, French, Portuguese in Africa was to divide up these colonies according to tribe, and each tribal area, you had to be a member of that tribal group to access land in that area. Right? So in other words, your ethnic identity was extremely important, and you instrumentalized it. You were able to use that ethnic identity to access land, right? And that gave that strong attachment between ethnicity and property rights. Right? So the idea is that when we start seeing people leaving the agrarian sector and entering the industrial sector, entering urban areas, leaving the countryside, the idea is that access to land becomes less important for them. Right, that association, that the ethnicity, the ethnic identity that they previously held so important to them because it allowed them to farm in a certain area or have access to land as a pastoralist, that is no longer so important because now they're part of this floating army of workers that exists in the urban environment. Again, by the way, Gellner and Marx use exactly those words, almost identical words, to talk about that, right? The structural transformation as people come into the industrial sector, they leave that behind. So that to some degree is what I'm talking about with the micro level foundations, right? That in areas where we lose that attachment to the land, we lose that attachment to ethnic specific capital, then we sort of, ethnicity might still be there, but it's just less important for people, right? It's still, as I said, that's the whole element of why I think the Afrobarometer data is really interesting, because you are explicitly forced to compare your ethnic to your national identity. You might still have them both. You still identify with your ethnic group. It's just less important to you. So I think, yeah, that I've answered both of those kind of together. Thinking about the U.S., I mean, the U.S., so again, if you think about industrialization, right, as generating a common sense of identity, another way, this relates back to Marx to some degree as well, right? What happens when countries industrialize? What are the kind of groups that form? It is trade unions, right? So all sorts of organizations of people who are working together, they form these groups, they form political parties. That's the origin of the Labor Party in this country, right? These are groups that are formed because of their working associations. What happens when these countries enter a post-industrial period is those groups fragment, right? And there's lots of literature from the comparative politics of developed countries that as countries enter sort of a post-industrial service sector economies, then this fragmentation of these formerly very strong labor unions and strong political parties, and that could explain the rise of populism among many parts of the post-industrial world. So that's not to say this is happening in Africa, but it certainly is happening in other parts of the world.
Okay.
Yeah. Gray shirt.
Several gray shirts there.
Yeah. Oh, sorry. Sorry, this gray shirt here, sorry. So gray shirt, burgundy, jumper, woman there. Yeah, you, yeah. Sorry, I'm doing the best I can.
This is a great lecture. I was here 30 years ago or more. We're talking about Africa, but as an American, the two concerns I have are China. I mean, China has had a really robust policy the last decade or more about entering developing countries, extracting resources, building bridges, and then possibly leaving some of the population there. So that's one side of the question. The other side of the question is the current BRIC meeting in Moscow, in Russia, has an alternative motive of kind of bifurcating the world into like the American side, the Western world, versus the BRIC. You know. Is there any benefit to Africa to playing the two sides, or should they be more suspicious of the Chinese motives?
You got the microphone, go. We'll do four of this round.
Just a quick question, a few things. I mean, industrialization causes national identity. Yeah, that's fine. I mean, obviously, you can see how it could do that. So it's very, you know, it can happen. I suppose what I was thinking is, are there factors sort of linked to what you're doing with that industrialization that are more important and important in certain cases? So, as you mentioned, perhaps how people are spending the taxes, how they're spending the profits, the type of industrialization. If you looked at gold mining, it's very different to coal mining. Who's benefiting? I mean, what is that? How is the industrialization being used? Okay. And lastly, I agree with that point about China. I thought, are China trying to get their one state ideal to another country? Are they spreading that? Is that
possible? You can hand the mic to, that's fine. And then we're going to go up to you here, and then we're going to let Elliot.
I think my question has been partly answered, but I'll pick up on a quote you made of Samora Machel. I think the rise of the nation, the death of the tribe.
Yeah.
And I recall an article I read a long time ago, I think Sebudu Budu on Botswana, and the role of the elites in nation building, so to speak. And from that article, I quite remember the nation state kind of emerged over and above the ethnic groups as an artificial construct, partly the colonial administrators,